This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio Eco Shock on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
To go outside.
To do my job. In the reservoir.
Oh, when did it get too hot?
Four years ago on Radio EcoShock, I asked if planet Earth could get so hot, it could be dangerous for most humans to go outside on many days of the year. Now, far too soon, a new report called Risky Business explains the majority of Americans will experience days too hot to go out for more than an hour or so without suffering heat stroke. Many will die. In just the southeast region of the United States by the end of this century, there will be somewhere between 11,000 and 36,000 more heat deaths every year on top of what we already get. They will have about 130 days a year, 4 months, of extreme temperatures. In the United States, as in many other parts of the world, there will be huge economic losses. Crop yields will fall as much as 50%, with some foods disappearing altogether. It will be too hot to work outside in the fields. In fact, all outdoor work from construction to forestry may have to be done at night during the summer. That's the start of a long-term trend where humans may have to become more nocturnal and build more underground just to survive temperatures so hot they have only appeared once before on this planet. Our early relative mammals survived only underground. Here is what makes this report doubly shocking. It's published by top business leaders and finance experts, including Republicans. When the 1% who own most of the wealth in the world realize their own money and real estate are threatened by global warming, you know we are in trouble. But maybe that could be the turning point where we finally see some real action to move away from fossil fuels, deforestation, and agribusiness that pollutes the atmosphere with dangerous gases. I'm going to play you short clips from the report's press conference. You will hear former Bush Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson say the climate threat to the economy is far greater than the 2007-2008 economic crash he helped stave off. The famous New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, himself a billionaire, explains we are heading into climate catastrophe. John Hopkins specialist Dr. Al Sommer explains how heat deaths work. And Clinton Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin warns we may not even be aware of the worst to come. Along those lines, I'll also be playing you the audio from a new interview of Cambridge polar expert Dr. Peter Wadhams. He says civilization is unlikely to survive if a 50 gigaton release of methane burps out of the rapidly warming Arctic. Two scientists, one Russian, one American, have explained how that is quite possible. Then we'll dive into the Radio EcoShock archives, where I interview bloggers John Cook of Skeptical Science and Stuart Staniford of Early Warning about the science of human tolerance for heat and humidity. I hope to have time to squeeze in my new climate song, Too Hot, and I hope you can use that as a tool to reach more people. Let's get busy with the opening remarks by Hank Paulson for the report Risky Business, The Economic Risks of Climate Change in the United States.
Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I'm Hank Paulson. I'm a co-chair of the Risky Business Project, and I'm very pleased to be joined on the dais today with my fellow Risk Committee members for this project. We've just completed a study which calculates and quantifies the various climate risks to our economy. And this is, I think, noteworthy. It's the first time this has been done. I have had a fair amount of experience over my career in attempting to understand and manage risk. And as I think many of you know, in 2008, I was the Treasury Secretary when a failure of risk management led to the 2008 financial crisis. Today, we are facing another looming crisis. And although it's not financial in nature, it still has a very significant economic threat to our economy. As a matter of fact, in many ways, the threat from the climate bubble is actually more cruel and more perverse, because, as I think many of you know, that when CO2 goes into the atmosphere, it stays there for many, many years. It's cumulative. And so there is no possibility for the government to come in with action at the last minute and prevent the very worst outcomes. Now, the study, which you will hear about today, identifies an overwhelming number of risks. And a big value of the study is the risk management perspective it brings. We use well understood risk management methodologies that businesses generally apply to managing their risks. So I think this is a very valuable aspect of the study. Now, as I said, it identifies a large number of risks. Many of these are already baked into the economy, but the good news is that if we act immediately, we can avoid the very worst outcomes. So a huge takeaway here is that taking a cautious approach, waiting for more information, a business-as-usual approach, is actually radical risk-taking. Because if you do this, you give us no opportunity to avoid the very most adverse outcomes. All we can do is adapt to them. So it's very important that the government and business act soon. And here I would emphasize the very important role that business has. I've worked with CEOs and businesses all around the world. I don't mean to sound parochial, but I think American companies are the best managed in the world. In many industries, we're the leaders. And we need to lead, American business needs to lead in this area. We need to take out an insurance policy. It's just that simple. Why the investment decisions that American companies are making today will have a lot to do with our economic future. So on that note, it's now my honor to turn it over to my friend and Risky Business co-chair, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Well, thank you, Hank. We've always had a saying, which I'm sure you all really, if you think about it, would agree with. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And that's why every business periodically conducts a comprehensive risk analysis to assess their vulnerabilities, whether they're financial or climate or anything else. But until today, we've had no ways to measure the serious risks to our national economy that it faces from climate change. And businesses and investors have largely been kept in the dark about how climate change will impact specific industries or specific regions. And that puts American businesses and the American economy in an extremely vulnerable position. This Risky Business report outlines climate risk by region and by industry, and it puts a concrete dollar figure on those risks for the first time. And this is critical information for businesses and investors to have as they plan for the future, and it makes the true cost of inaction on climate change frighteningly clear. Our report shows that the longer we wait to adapt to and mitigate climate change, the more devastating the economic impacts will be. And Hank, I thought, described that very well. We just cannot afford to wait another minute, because climate change is costing local governments and businesses billions of dollars, and no competent executive is going to walk away from thinking about what could happen and taking appropriate actions if that were to occur. We saw firsthand what can happen in New York City with Hurricane Sandy. And while we can't say that any one storm was caused by climate change, there's no question that rising sea levels and ocean temperature made Sandy worse, and that they make extreme weather more frequent. There's also no question that New York City is far from alone in being vulnerable to extreme weather. Our analysis shows within just the next 15 years, annual damages to states on the East Coast and along the Gulf Coast could reach up to something like $35 billion. Now, in other parts of the country, more frequent and severe heat waves have threatened public health and impacted labor productivity. In some states with large agricultural industries, it will literally be too hot and humid to safely work outside for many days of the year, and that will drive food costs up and put our energy grid under tremendous stress. It's also true that some crops that we've grown here won't be able to grow when the climate changes, and you can see that in the forests where insects that are destroying the forest usually used to get killed off in cold weather, and now they're not getting killed off, and the number of trees that are brown and just in our big forests is really scary. It's also true that if you go and look at glaciers, and a friend of mine sent me an email yesterday from Alaska, it's just frightening how far back the glaciers have melted just in the last 5 or 10 years. We have to plan for risks, and we have to take every possible step to avoid them. Climate change is one of them. And considering the tremendous losses American businesses will suffer if we do nothing to slow climate change, and how much of those losses can be avoided by smart, prudent, rapid action, American businesses, we think, should lead the charge, and we hope this report will mobilize the business community and forge consensus for national action across the aisle. And we'll continue working with leaders from the business community to urge Congress to make that happen and to urge other business leaders with their own companies to make that happen, because every city, every company, every state, and the federal government all can do something to make a big difference here. Hank, thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to remarks made at the press release June 24th in New York City of a stunning report on climate, human health, and the economy. It's called Risky Business. Next up is a former Clinton Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin. Bob Rubin was also CEO and co-chair of Goldman Sachs, as well as a board member of Citigroup.
Next, Bob Rubin, who also knows something about risk management, former Secretary of Treasury, who has the dubious distinction of being also my former boss.
It was dubious, actually. I think the following. I have come to believe that climate change is the existential issue of our age. I don't believe that we have a focus or an action in relation to it that is remotely commensurate with the risk that we face. I believe that if we don't effectively address climate change, that the effects can not only be severe, as pointed out in this report, and Tom referred to them as significant, but I believe they can be catastrophic. Greenhouse gases have a decay rate in the atmosphere of centuries, hundreds of years. What we do today will affect us for centuries. The report, as Tom said, does show significant effects, but I think significant vastly understates what we face, because if you look at that report, what you see is possible negative feedback loops, possible vicious cycles that are far from remote possibilities. I think they are very realistic possibilities that could lead to catastrophic effects. With that, I'd like to make four specific comments. One, I believe that investors should insist that companies disclose their exposure to climate risk, and that would include costs they may someday have to absorb in order to address carbon emissions. It includes the value of assets that could be stranded by future climate change measures and the actual impact that climate change could have. Then investors could make more fully informed decisions about risks, and I think it would also provide an incentive for business to act. Secondly, the investment and business communities can work to change the public conversation, and I think that's critical if we're going to get political action, and then also engage with the political sector in order to move forward on public policy, and public policy is absolutely key. Thirdly, climate change is very likely to create substantial future fiscal costs that have not been included in any current budgetary projections. The federal government has historically provided for natural disasters, has provided emergency relief with respect to health care and agricultural crises. Those are likely to be more frequent with climate change. As I said, that would increase very substantially fiscal costs, and there's no accounting for them in current projections. And finally, I believe that GDP, as currently measured, does not accurately reflect what's happening in the economy because it does not include the externalities like greenhouse gas emissions and the tremendous costs they could have. And a misguided measure of what's happening in our economy can lead to misguided policy.
Henry Cisneros was the first Hispanic American mayor of San Antonio, Texas, and served as the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, in the Clinton administration. He's now chairman of Cityview Companies. Finally, we have someone in the real estate industry who speaks up about the coming price carnage, coming as multi-million-dollar coastal properties become worthless due to rising seas and extreme storm surge. Eventually, most of Florida real estate will go under, along with the land. The Risky Business Report suggests between $238 billion and $507 billion of coastal property will be lost to the sea.
Next, Henry Cisneros, the former Secretary of HUD, who is also quite an expert on this topic.
Mr. Secretary, thank you. As former Secretary of Housing, traveled to 200 different American cities in every one of the 50 states, and for the last 20 years have been involved in real estate, I want to say a few words about the implications of climate change for one specific business sector, which is real estate. No business sector is more likely to be impacted by climate change than the real estate sector. When you think of it, real estate is anchored in physical geography, so it's tied to the physical reality of places. And it's driven by demand, which is to say where people want to live, where businesses grow. So there are a lot of people involved in that physical space. There are a number of ways, specific ways, in which climate change will impact real estate. And real estate leaders and investors need to be thinking about this. One is the reality that coastal properties and infrastructure are at the risk of inundation from rising seas and storm surge that accompanies hurricanes. These two forces, rising seas and hurricanes, when combined, put a significant amount of coastal property at risk in the United States. As the seas continue to rise, each storm will push water further inland, increasing the scale of the damages. So, as Donna said earlier, Miami faces a real danger. But it's not alone. Norfolk and our major naval facilities there. Houston, the world energy center that it is. Cities like Wilmington and Atlantic City. And, of course, in New York, we saw what the future may look like in the experience from Hurricane Sandy. And the storms are only likely to get worse. So developers, builders, and community leaders have to be cognizant of the implications of climate change. Other quick indications. Dry areas in the United States, the science tells us, will be drier, which means major implications for the western United States and its major cities. These are some of the fastest growth areas in the country, and they'll be faced with water shortages. We're already seeing permits being limited in particular states and for cities, which has implications then for where developers can build, where people can live, where growth will occur. California is allocating water from its state reservoirs for the first time in its history. Higher temperatures means higher energy costs, which means higher expenses for power generation. Again, economic development is shaped in part in our new economy by where power reserves are available. It means huge expenses for additional power, given the need for massive air conditioning as temperatures rise in places that have not been that hot until now. Extreme temperatures also, as Mayor Bloomberg said, have productivity dimensions. That is to say, you can't work in construction the same hours in the same ways with extreme heat. It's just not possible to be on the roof of a house in Phoenix today, but when Phoenix temperatures are mirrored in multiple states across the country for more than a few days a year, but for months, it has massive implications for business. So it's important to look at these things and look at them from an economic perspective. Matters of insurance, for example, whether insurance can be gotten at all in coastal areas, changes the workings of our economy. It's important for people in the real estate sector to pay attention. And I think that's what this report tries to do for the first time, is cast climate change in terms of business people can be attentive. And it means involvement in paying attention to the science, but also being involved with the public sector organizations and the nonprofits that are beginning to think through what are the things that we can realistically do. Too often in American life, and I'll close with this point, people who think they're not directly involved sit on the sidelines until it's too late. The real estate sector is accustomed to sort of the business cycle and waits out the cycle. This is not about a cycle. This is a long-term game changer for the country and for an industry that, if it isn't paying attention, will be directly involved.
That was Henry Cisneros. Now we have Al Sommer. He's the Dean Emeritus of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Here's his short and bitter explanation of how humans die from heat.
And now, last but not least, Al Sommer, the retired dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins.
Right. Retired but not retiring.
Right. Thanks very much.
That's for sure.
So there's an old joke that it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Well, for public health, it's both the heat and the humidity, because when it's humid outside and hot, your sweat can evaporate. And when it can't evaporate, you can't regulate your core body temperature. And that leads to a dramatic increase in heat stroke and therefore deaths. As people have been mentioning, it's going to get a lot hotter in the United States over the next 100 years and worse going forward. Montana summers will soon be the same as New Mexico today. That's the reason why I'm vacationing in Montana this year and not putting it off. There will be 10 to 20 times as many incremental deaths because of excess heat and humidity by 100 years from now. But if we don't do something now, you can't turn it off later. And as my friend Henry Cisneros has said, labor productivity is going to go way down. Now, this is the average risky business, but as Bob Rubin has pointed out to us repeatedly, you really have to think about the tails as well. This is the average. This is the most likely outcome, and it's not good. The tails are the less likely horrendous outcomes, which will be much worse. And the reason we take out insurance against fire and floods and what have you is for those less likely events that eventually do happen and happen unexpectedly. And it will be too late to take out insurance for the whole United States once this is entirely baked into the system.
Dean Sommer told the press, Montana summers will soon be the same as New Mexico today. It will become, according to the report, impossible to go outside there without some kind of air-conditioned suit for about 20 days a year. Greg Page, the executive chairman of the world's largest grains company, Cargill, also spoke, but frankly, he used public relations talk extolling the can-do powers of farmers to adapt to climate change. In my opinion, even Superman can't grow crops when the rain doesn't fall or extreme heat or floods wipe out the fields. Others who have made statements supporting this new report include former United States Senator Olympia Snowe, billionaire environmental supporter Tom Steyer, and Bush-era Secretary of State and Treasury George Shultz. Professor of Political Science and President of the University of Miami, Donna Shalala, minced no words on the clear threat posed by climate change to her state. You can find links to all those videos, statements, and the report in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, or go to riskybusiness.org. I don't know about you, but I wasn't sure I would live to hear top financial experts from both political parties admitting global warming is becoming an almost unstoppable catastrophe. It will threaten the entire wealth structure of America and the world. I feel vindicated and even more worried at the same time. Even by 2050, not all that far away, the average American will experience 2 or 3 times more days over 95 degrees than we have now, or 36 degrees Celsius. By the end of the century, that becomes about 3 months of such weather. Imagine it. So what you say? Well, first, a warmer atmosphere holds more water. This higher humidity will combine with higher temperatures to kill many of us. We can only sweat ourselves cool enough to avoid heat stroke if the heat and humidity are below certain levels, and we'll find out more about that later in this program. Second, if you think air conditioning will handle it all, consider our grid and power sources are already at the breaking point in the hot weather. The price of oil, coal, and gas will continue to go up as we go beyond the peak of what can be produced at reasonable prices. We can't burn all those fossil fuels anyway without completely roasting out the planet. Can we really expect solar and wind power to cool off all our inefficient shopping malls, office towers, homes, and industrial plants? I doubt it. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock on Co-op Radio 100.5 FM, Vancouver. Bob Rubin raised the problem of extreme changes that are not even quantified by the official Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There's plenty of news from the Arctic to back that up. I could spend 3 programs just updating you on the hot Arctic, the superheat cell hovering over Siberia, and the giant forest fires there. But here is the head of the Cambridge University Polar Science Unit, Dr. Peter Wadhams, being interviewed by Nick Breeze for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group.
Can you explain what impact a 50 gigaton release of methane would have on the atmosphere and what the effects would be for life on Earth and in particular humanity?
Well, we modelled in a paper to Nature, we modelled the effect of a 50 gigaton release, and you convert the methane into the carbon dioxide equivalent effect and look at what that does to global temperatures. And it turned out that the global temperatures are increased by about a maximum of about 6.6 of a degree, and that's achieved within 20 years of the original emission. We assume the emission takes place over 10 years, that 20 years after the emission starts, the temperature has risen 0.6 of a degree, and that's a pretty substantial addition to global warming. And then we calculated using an economic model, that's the same model that the Stern Review used, what that would cost for the world economy, and it turned out to be $60 trillion over a century. Now, that's a huge figure, but if you compare it with the figure that the Stern Review had come up with for the total cost to the world of carbon emissions, which that comes out to be more like $700 trillion. So the $60 trillion additional is adding about 10% to the cost of global warming, but that's still substantial.
Is there research to show we're on course for such a large release of methane? And if the answer is yes, how solid do you think that research is?
Well, the solid research that shows that releases are happening, and the work that this Russian-US group from University of Alaska and the Pacific Oceanographic Lab has been doing every summer in the East Siberian Sea is showing that each year you're seeing more and more methane emissions from the seabed, which are reaching the surface because the water's very shallow, about 70 metres deep. And so we've seen lots of photos and film and data from them showing these emissions, and we're going to be joining in with them next year in that work. So there's solid evidence of seabed emissions of methane from the shallow shelves. There's also solid evidence of methane emissions from deeper water off Spitsbergen, but there the methane has time to dissolve in the water on its way up, so it's not directly released into the atmosphere, whereas the methane on these shallow shelves is. So that's pretty solid. The question of quantity is the more difficult question, because looking at the present rates of emission and looking at the methane hydrate content of sediments is what enables you to estimate how much methane is going to be released from a further melting of sediments or due to the warmer water. And that estimate, at the moment, we have to rely on Shakova and Semiletov, who've been doing that work, and they have then expert knowledge of the seabed conditions, and they're the ones who are estimating the 50 gigatons. So that could be revised up or down if further work is done in that area.
And do you think civilization could survive a 50 gigaton release of methane?
No, I don't think it can. I think that if you look at the existing predictions of global warming rates, what's kind of eerie is the fact that the business as usual projections, even the cautious ones produced by IPCC, are still giving us about 4 degrees of warming by the end of the century. And with 2 degrees has been taken arbitrarily as the level beyond which nasty things happen. I don't know why it's 2 degrees, but that will be reached by the middle of the century and 4 degrees by the end of the century. Now, 4 degrees, people who've calculated what that would do to food production, to die-off of forests, to acceleration of warming due to various extra feedbacks that kick in, that the general conclusion is pretty dire, that if you get to 4 degrees of warming, then collapse of civilization is what's going to happen, because the world won't be able to sustain anywhere near its present population. So the result will be chaos and warfare. So that's just that the eerie thing is that that's predicted by the IPCC report, but the projection of warming by the end of the century is 4 degrees. But nowhere do they state at all that 4 degrees is a catastrophe for economically and socially for the planet. And now with this Arctic methane, you're simply adding another another element to the warming, even if it's only an extra 0.6. That brings forward the date at which catastrophic warming is achieved by maybe another, maybe 20 years. So we get, we're going to get into a state where the warming rate is giving us something that will cause society to break down. And we're going to get to that state quicker because of offshore emissions of methane than would be the case otherwise.
Will we get that 50 gigaton burst of methane? No one knows for sure. It could all come down to good luck or an undersea landslide or quake. Meanwhile, as Wadham says, we do know more and more methane is leaking out of the frozen methane clathrates as the Arctic Sea warms to extraordinary temperatures, especially with no sea ice cover. We won't even get into the methane clouds rising from land sources as the permafrost melts. This is Co-op Radio Vancouver, 100.5 FM, a little left on your dial. This is the Radio EcoShock Summer Special on extreme heat. And I asked two popular bloggers, why are most of the public blissfully unaware of how heat kills? Do you know the operating temperature of your skin? And no, it's not 98.6 or 37 degrees C. Let's get to the mechanics of how humans cool themselves and why we may not be able to in a hotter and more humid world. We'll start with a slightly shorter version of my 2010 interview with John Cook, host of the popular Skeptical Science blog and video series. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. What if Earth becomes too hot for humans to function outside? Science fiction or real science? Let's investigate with Australian blogger John Cook. His well-known blog is called Skeptical Science. John studied physics at the University of Queensland, Australia. He's not a climate scientist, but he relies on peer-reviewed papers by others. Like many of us, John was drawn to a startling new paper recently published in PNAS, The Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It combines work by an Australian, Dr. Stephen C. Sherwood, from the University of New South Wales, and an American scientist, Matthew Huber, from Purdue Climate Change Research Center. Sherwood and Huber investigated the upper limits of human survival in a warming world. Their paper is called An Adaptability Limit to Climate Change Due to Heat Stress. So, John Cook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this scientific paper important to the rest of us?
I guess one of the key results is, and I get this on my website a lot, is people say, well, no matter how hot it gets, you know, we can adapt. We can, you know, we'll get used to it, or we'll, turn up the air conditioner or something. But what the paper finds is there is a limit on what we can adapt to, and the human body needs to be warmer than its environment to cool down. So once the temperature gets over a certain point, the body just can't cool down. And at that point, you know, we can go through hypothermia or heat stroke, and, you know, health issues become important.
You know, it's strange that we go through so much education and yet many of us don't really know how our body works, you know, what temperature our skin needs to be and why perspiration is there. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not a medical expert either, but I can give you the basics of it. like our inner body needs to be regulated at, I think it's around 37 or 39 degrees. And so in order for our body to release heat, the skin temperature needs to be at about 35 degrees. So for that to happen, the air temperature needs to be at a cooler than that. But also what's important is the humidity. You'll find if you're in dry air, the body can cool down easier because it's easier for the sweat to evaporate. But if it's humid, it's harder to cool down, which I guess is when you're in really hot, humid environments, just really uncomfortable. Once conditions get to the point where it's either too hot or too humid or both, and the body can't cool down, that's when the body starts to struggle.
Right. And also, there's something in the paper. We need to go and explain the difference between wet bulb temperature and the numbers that we're used to seeing on a thermometer or a weather forecast. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was talking about humidity and how that changes our ability to evaporate and cool. The definition that scientists use to work out what temperature our body needs to be at is the wet bulb temperature. What that strictly means is if you took a thermometer and you covered it with like a wet cloth and it was fully ventilated, you know, there was air blowing past it, whatever temperature the thermometer gave you is a wet bulb temperature. And what the paper found is that the wet bulb temperature can get no hotter than 35 degrees. If we spend more than a couple of hours hotter than that, then you'll get hypothermia.
Right, and that's hyperthermia, listeners. We're used to hearing hypothermia for cold, but hyperthermia is we call it heat stroke as well sometimes. So the paper says we can't really go over 35 degrees in wet bulb temperature, around 95 Fahrenheit in humid conditions. But right now on Earth, we seldom exceed 31 degrees of wet bulb temperature. So, John, why worry?
Well, what the paper found was that if we experience warming of about, let me see, I think it was up to 7 degrees, like large regions of the Earth would actually become uninhabitable. We expect, you know, about maybe 1 degree over the next 50 years or so, depending on how our carbon emissions change. But as we go further into the future, that's just going to, you know, the temperature range will get a lot further than that, depending on what our carbon trajectory is now. So probably the most startling result I got from this paper was that we talk about rising sea levels a lot and how as sea levels rise, that will make a lot of regions uninhabitable. But what this paper found was the corresponding temperature rise will make even more regions uninhabitable. So I think heat stress is something that probably doesn't get as much attention as other issues to do with global warming. But what we're observing is there are actually more people dying, like currently, from heat stress than other natural disasters like hurricanes and floods. So, yeah, it's something that will get worse over time, but it's also something that's happening now. In fact, over the last few weeks, Pakistan and India are experiencing like record heat waves, the hottest on record. And hundreds of people are dying there because a lot of remote rural villages just don't have access to, I guess, air conditioners or ways to cool themselves down.
Right. I've been reading about that with some alarm. The latest reports I saw were well over 1,000 dead in India alone and Pakistan.
I hadn't been up there. The last couple of days, a few days ago, I saw several hundred. They said that was likely to be an underestimate because a lot of the reports hadn't come in from the remote villages.
And, of course, they don't have as tight a medical system for measuring just why did this person die. But we're also finding that certain portions of the population are more likely to die. Obviously, I think that includes seniors, but also younger children are passing away, and surprisingly, some people with mental illnesses are twice as likely to die from heat stroke.
Okay, I hadn't heard that. I read a statistic this morning. I think it was just in Australia, but it surprised me, actually. It said that about 10% of the heat stroke deaths were children, and about like 40% were elderly, but just over 50% were the like 10 to 60 year olds. So yeah, although the, obviously the elderly and the young are especially vulnerable, there was still a greater proportion were, you know, that just middle range of age. I thought it would have been more elderly, but yeah, that statistic surprised me a little.
It surprises me, too. And I know you mentioned the map provided by Sherwood and Huberb in their study, and they say that the sort of lack of habitability of certain areas starts at 7 degrees centigrade from where we are now. But when you get around 11 or 12, they show you another map, which includes large parts of South America, big hunks of Asia, big parts of China, and Australia being totally uninhabitable for humans. They just couldn't go outside and do any work, which would include agriculture, I presume, too. So, I mean, here we have Australia maybe become uninhabitable in 200 or 300 years, and yet the country's ramping up its coal exports. Does the government or the public realize even this extreme risk?
I don't think so, no. And I think the government is more concerned about the next election cycle than, you know, conditions a century or more into the future. And that's one of the main problems, I think. It's just hard for us to imagine things that happen so far into the future.
But we have to care about whether our country will go on and our civilization will go on. This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with John Cook, host of the blog SkepticalScience.com. John, you've accumulated a good community of commenters on your blog as well, and one entry really caught my attention about this heat situation. He said, the difficulty with air conditioning is that most household air conditioners are only rated up to about 41 degrees centigrade, some to 43 degrees, I think. When the temperature rises to 51 C for any length of time, like a summer heat wave, we'll either have to invent better air conditioners and dehumidifiers or find another way to keep cool. And he points out that's only 4 degrees C warmer than it got in the heat wave in Melbourne in southern Australia last year. So there may be limitations to that fallback strategy of air conditioning, not to mention the increased loads often lead to power failures anyway. Can you tell us something about the heat events that you have experienced in Australia in the last year or two?
Well, Australia is... We seem to be copying a lot of the global warming impacts, maybe are less than you might be experiencing over there. But in Brisbane a few years ago, we had a heat wave where about just over 20 people died. In Melbourne or in Victoria, in the southeast of Australia, it's been hot and dry. And the result of that is that it's the bushfire conditions are like they've had to invent a new scale because the danger has gotten so high. And, you know, we've experienced some very severe bushfires because of that, and whole towns getting gutted over the last few years. So, yeah, there's just been a gradual, I guess, evolution of more heat waves and more dire conditions.
From Australia, we've been talking extreme heat with John Cook, host of the Skeptical Science blog at skepticalscience.com. John, thank you so much for your continuing work and the insight you've given us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM. You can download that full John Cook interview from a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info or listen to it at our Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. Don't forget our interview on climate and human health with Dr. Elizabeth Hanna from Australia National University. That's from our show November 27th, 2013. Download that super full interview with Dr. Elizabeth Hanna from our website at ecoshock.org or my show blog at ecoshock.info. Back in 2010, another inquiring mind, Stuart Staniford, looked into humans trying to work in extreme heat in Pakistan. The difference, of course, is Pakistan has a drier heat, whereas the rest of us will get a deadly double dose of heat and high humidity. Staniford is the host of the Early Warning blog. Find the link to the full interview in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I like people who can dig into problems and find insights the rest of us miss. That's why I've called up Stuart Staniford. He has a doctorate in physics and a master's in computer science. By day, Stewart is chief scientist for the computer security company FireEye. By night, he's a well-known energy commentator, especially at theoildrum.com and on his own blog, Early Warning. Stewart, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Sure, you're welcome. Thanks, Alex.
Well, look, your blog is called Early Warning, Risks to Global Civilization. An article you posted on May 6th certainly caught my attention and bounced all over the net. Really, it was the inspiration for this program. The title is Odds of Cooking the Grandkids. What inspired you to write that?
Well, it came out of a paper that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by two scientists, Stephen Sherwood at the University of New South Wales and Matthew Huber at Purdue University here in the U.S. And they were basically looking at, you know, there is this possibility that what's called the climate sensitivity, how much the temperature is going to increase as a result of our increasing carbon dioxide, there's a small possibility that it will be really high and that temperatures will go really high. And so they were looking at, you know, which portions of the planet would become uninhabitable in that scenario, in the sense that, you know, if you go outside in the summer, then, you know, you just wouldn't be able to physiologically make it for any length of time.
And you wouldn't be able to do meaningful work, and we'll get to that. Well, look, we've talked about the idea of wet bulb temperature with our other guest, John Cook, but that is the key, isn't it? High temperatures and high humidity.
No, that's right. I mean, the higher the humidity, the less good sweating does you. So there comes a point where if the humidity is high enough and the temperature is high enough, then your body just can't cool itself when your core temperature gets higher and higher, and then eventually you go into heat shock.
In another article, you look at the demographics of heat deaths. Who is most likely to die?
Obviously, the elderly are more likely, or very young children if they're exposed to outside temperatures. And then people doing manual labor outside obviously face significantly higher risk.
I find that when we say that old people will die, people tend to shrug that off if they're not old, but not realizing that we're all going to be old people and our lives will matter to us. And, you know, here in Canada, the number of people over 65 is expected to double by 2036. And sometime just 5 years from now, there will be more seniors in Canada than children age 14 and under. So we could have a lot of deaths, and even those who do survive hyperthermia, as heat strokes are called medically, the survivors often have brain damage and they require serious care. If heat waves do become more common, as some scientists predict, wouldn't this be a huge drain on families and on the economy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, eventually, yeah. I mean, obviously it's one of those things that's going to creep up on us over the course of the century, right? I mean, it's not going to be like suddenly, you know, this massive heat wave is much worse than we used to. It's going to be more like with each passing decade, there's a little more likely to be really serious heat waves. And then depending on just how sensitive the climate is to our carbon emissions, could get really, really bad by the end of the century. You know, or if we're lucky and it's not as sensitive as it might be, then it'll be less serious. But obviously there are some parts of the planet where heat shock's already a problem, and they're almost certainly going to get somewhat worse.
Well, that was something I wanted to get to in another entry in your Early Warning blog. You wondered if there are parts of the world already approaching these human heat limits, and you cite the possible example in India, and that was published before the recent heat waves, with thousands of deaths that just happened in India, not to mention the new record high in Pakistan, 53.7 Celsius, or 129 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of May. Can you tell us what you found out about those quarry workers in India?
Yeah, well, so I had looked at these maps that Shepard and Huber had put in their paper of, you know, where the planet was going to become uninhabitable. And kind of the area that was already worst was a band across part of the Amazon and then a band across northern India and Pakistan. And so I was sort of scouting around looking for scientific information on that area, and I came across this study by an Institute of Occupational Health in India that was looking at the situation of various kinds of manual workers in Gujarat and Rajasthan states in northern India. And basically the conclusion of that study was these guys, particularly in this quarry in Rajasthan that was one of the study sites, were pretty much already at the limit of, you know, there were already a number of them that were suffering quite serious symptoms like confusion and complete collapse every so often as a result of working in this quarry. So it was pretty clear that working outside in the summer in those parts of India during a heat wave is already very marginal as something that humans can do. And obviously the recent news that you just mentioned has only made it clearer. So, you know, it's clear that those areas are going to be in trouble, you know, are already in some degree of trouble, and that's going to get worse pretty quickly.
Well, we have a form of denial, I say, here in the West that we'll all be fine due to air conditioning, but that depends upon increasing our energy supply, and if we apply it to other parts of the world, we'd have to expand world energy production just as we hit what some people think is peak oil. Your work's pretty well known on that. Do you think that air conditioning is really realistic when we start talking about India and China and Africa and South America?
It's hard to say. I mean, the problem is that oil itself is not, by and large, in the developed world anyway, used for generating electricity, which is what obviously powers air conditioners. So in principle, there's no connection to peak oil. However, it places a strain on overall energy demand, and obviously to the extent that we're meeting most of our electricity production demand from coal, there's this sort of nasty feedback loop where as the planet warms up, we need more electricity and more coal to power air conditioning, and that in turn is further increases the climate change, right? So I think that's a significant problem. And at the moment, you know, India and China and those countries are getting wealthier, and just that alone will tend to increase their demand for electricity and for air conditioning in particular. So I think, I mean, there's definitely a serious question as we get out towards the end of the 21st century, whether we're just going to end up in this sort of spiraling situation of ever hotter temperatures and ever more energy demand creating ever hotter temperatures. It seems like that would be really ugly. To the extent we're able to transition to predominantly renewable and or nuclear, you know, basis for our society, then it could be in much better shape.
Still, it's not a very pleasing picture to think that we'll have to huddle inside air-conditioned rooms possibly for a week at a time, afraid to go out.
Yeah, absolutely. And depending on where you are, I mean, you guys up in Canada, I mean, the research shows that people's happiness is strongly affected by the extremes of temperature, right? So in extremely cold climates, it tends to be the coldest portions of the year that have the most influence on people's mental state. Of when you ask them how is life going overall, you know, if they live in a place that's either very, very cold in the winter or very, very hot in the summer, that tends to have a negative effect on how happy they say they are. So, you know, up in Canada, there'll be some benefit in mitigating the winter extremes. But in places like, you know, for example, the eastern half of the U.S. that are already hot and humid in the summer, I think it's going to get just uglier and uglier over time.
Well, there you go. When inquiring minds want to know, they can turn to the Early Warning blog at earlywarnblogspot.com or look for Stuart Stanford's work at theoildrum.com, energybulletin.net, and other spots around the net. And Stuart, I'd really like to thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Alex.
That was Stuart Stanford from our Radio EcoShock show, June 11th, 2010. Find Stuart at earlywarn.blogspot.ca. Radio EcoShock was literally years ahead of the mass media in covering this issue. Be sure to stay tuned as we go for climate change and our future as no one else does. Find all our past programs, most of them as valid as the day they were born, as free MP3 files at our website, ecoshock.org. My show blog is at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. You'll find all the links to the Risky Business Report, some Arctic news, plus my new climate song, all at ecoshock.info. So here is that song, just right for today's news and the news of tomorrow. It's called Too Hot. Please forward links to this song to all your friends and contacts in social media. We need a Twitter and Facebook barrage to get the music out of climate change and the word out about this radio program. Thank you for demanding a better world.
To do my job. In the reservoir.
Oh, when did it get too hot?
Important issue over time, and if we don't do something about it in the next 10 years, it might be too late.
Not much left
in the reservoir.
Much left
in the field.
Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.